Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Ladies and gentlemen, my fellow Americans.
The state of our union is getting stronger.
Also, more repetitive. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Wednesday, the 25th of January. Good to have you here. It says right there in Article 2 of the Constitution that the president shall, from time to time, give to the Congress information of the State of the Union. What it doesn't tell you is that they're going to say the same thing, especially when they're talking about the economy, and in particular, in years of presidential reelection campaigns. Here's Ronald Reagan in the election year of 1984.
It would be immoral to make those who are paying taxes pay more to compensate for those who aren't paying their share.
President Barack Obama, the election year of this year.
Right now, Warren Buffett pays a lower tax rate than his secretary.
Candidate and incumbent Bill Clinton, 1996.
Do you believe we can expand the economy without hurting the environment? I do.
Candidate and incumbent Obama, last night.
We don't have to choose between our environment and our economy.
Finally, George H.W. Bush, 1992.
We must encourage investment. We must make it easier for people to invest money and create new products, new industries, and new jobs.
And finally, Mr. Obama, last night.
Support the same kind of research and innovation that led to the computer chip and the internet, to new American jobs and new American industries.
Almost 30 years worth of Democrats and Republicans talking about the economy. Among those listening to the State of the Union last night and paying close attention to the bits about jobs and the economy and inequality in America today was Jay Damian. We had her on the broadcast yesterday, touching base about what she wanted to hear from the president. She was part of a roundtable we did back in September after a big job speech from the White House. We got her back in to talk about the president's speech last night. Jay, welcome back.
Thank you.
So as you just heard, presidents over time tend to say a lot of the same things. Did Barack Obama say anything last night that gives you hope?
Well, he did say several things. I liked what he was talking about, the job creation programs by partnering with community colleges.
Mm-hmm.
I liked what he said about expanding trade. He also talked about giving tax credits, right, you know, reforming the whole tax system for keeping businesses in the U.S. instead of them outsourcing. So he did bring up some good ideas, but the question is, when is this going to happen?
Yeah, obviously not soon enough for people who are looking for work like yourself, but I have to say you are far more positive today than I figured you would be.
Well, what I really liked was, in my opinion, I thought he was challenging Congress to say, hey, you guys have got to come together.
On the politics of it.
On the politics of it and put your differences aside, because it's not about the politics, it's about the people right now.
What if he had given this speech back in September when we had you and the roundtable in after his big job speech?
I think that you would have had a totally different opinion for the panel that day. This is something that he should have said back in September. And I question the fact of, if these were some of his thoughts, why did it take so long to come back and, you know, bring these out to the people?
Mm-hmm. He talked a lot last night about equality and fairness and the wealth gap. How do you think we're doing on that right now?
Well, it doesn't make any sense that Warren Buffett's secretary pays more taxes than he does. I mean, come on. But I don't really necessarily believe that the rich should pay more taxes. I believe everybody should pay the same thing.
You've talked a lot about when's it going to happen. How long are you going to give him? How long does he have?
I think he has until the election. I mean, he's got to be able to pass something before the election comes.
Boom. That's it.
That's it. Because otherwise, it's just all talk.
Jay, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
I don't know if Ben Bernanke was at the president's speech last night because he had a busy, busy day today. The Fed wrapped up a two-day meeting on interest rates, after which we learned it's not just the politicians who are worried about the economy this year.
We are obviously hoping that the strength we saw in the fourth quarter and in recent data will continue into 2012. But we're going to continue to monitor that situation. I don't think we're ready to declare that we've entered a new, stronger phase at this point.
It's never a good thing when the Fed says it's going to continue to monitor anything. Traders on Wall Street, though, took heart in Mr. Bernanke's promise of low interest rates till 2014. Yes, I said 2014. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. In Cairo, Egypt, on the anniversary of the first protest that led to the fall of Hosni Mubarak, tens of thousands of people made their way to Tahrir Square today.
I'm celebrating the departure of Mubarak.
We are here because nothing happened during the last year, and we have to continue our revolution.
It's celebrations as well as continuing the revolution.
It was Mahmoud Mustafa, Nadine Shams, and Megad Mohammed recorded in Tahrir Square this evening. It does seem fair to say that people think there's some unfinished business after the revolution that changed everything. Our series this week on Egypt's post-Mubarak economy is called One Year On. And Marketplace's Stephen Beard is in Cairo, finding that though there is more democracy, the economy has taken a beating.
In a tiny basement room, Zeynep Khalifa and her team of four jewelry craftsmen are at work, cutting, shaping, and burnishing a glittering array of rings and pendants, brooches and bracelets, while sharing their gloomy views on the current state of Egypt.
In the beginning, we were very, very happy. Revolution come to free us, and we all going to have real freedom. But now we are not very optimistic about it.
The continuing unrest has kept millions of foreign visitors away from Egypt. Tourism is down by as much as 80% in Cairo. The economy has slowed sharply. Zeynep's revenues have fallen by half.
Everything's not stable. People, they don't spend as much. Of course, when the economy is like this, people, they don't spend that much. So we are not really in a very good state, really, in business.
ليه يا كوكي كل الناس بيحبوكي
في خير مزارع مصر ربوكي.
A TV ad pushes the merits of Koki's fried chicken. The company that makes it employs 11,000 people, and since the revolution, its sales and profits have remained steady. But company boss Tarek Tawfik admits that investment and expansion have largely ground to a halt.
There is no foreign direct investment. Even Egyptians investing in the country has been holding on until there is a better vision of what will ensue.
And he says the political paralysis has not made it any easier to do business in Egypt.
Getting permits, you know, permits to build, permits to operate in a factory, in a store, it's a nightmare. The bureaucracy has been stifling.
There's no doubt that the Egyptian economy is in a much worse state since the revolution. Spending on big government construction projects has slumped. And that's hit one of Cairo's biggest consulting civil engineers, Mandour Hamsa.
We are in this company now, suffering. We reduce our workforce. We don't have project.
He says he's lost millions over the past year and had to shed half his workforce, some 300 people. But the irascible Mr. Hamsa is not pleased when I suggest the revolution is to blame.
Rubbish!
He blames the ruling military council for mismanaging the economy and the political process. But he says business people should not complain about the bumps along the road to democracy.
Nothing is for free. They have to pay hardship for a while, for their freedom, for their dignity, for their future. There's a price to have to be paid. And everybody must know that. The price have to be paid.
Jewelry maker Zeynep Khalifa knows that only too well and is prepared to pay it.
We are very much going to fight to keep the people working, to fight to keep our business open, to fight even for more freedom. We are now prepared to fight.
But it could be a long fight. She believes it could be 10 years before her business fully recovers. In Cairo, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Part of what we've been looking at this week, as we mark a year since the protests in Tahrir Square, is how closely, if at all, the Arab Spring and Occupy Wall Street were connected. Ahmed Naguib is an Egyptian pro-democracy activist. He was out in Tahrir Square again today. Tammy Shapiro is an Occupy Wall Street organizer in New York. And we got them together to explore our theory of common ground and where both movements might go from here. Good to have you both with us.
Great to be here.
Thank you.
Ahmed, let me ask you, first of all, when you looked at Occupy Wall Street and when you saw that happening last fall in New York and then across this country, what were you thinking?
I was thinking good for them, because I believe that our generation is all about change. And I don't see what's happening in the States, nor Greece, nor Spain, or other countries in Europe, and even India and this Arab Spring as detached. In essence, we're all after the same thing. You know, those bankers and politicians that failed us and has increased, you know, the margins of poverty all around the world. We need to fix that system.
Tammy Shapiro, that line he just said, we're all after the same thing. You agree with that?
I think we are. I think our struggles look different. They have different flavors to them. But at the end of the day, we're working for a system that works for everyone. Right. I think an important difference is the violence that we face. You know, I think that people in Egypt are really putting their lives on the line. And while some folks in the Occupy movement are putting their future on the line or, you know, dropping everything and we don't know where things are going to go, we're not facing the same kind of violence and repression.
Ahmed, this is a little bit sideways, but it occurs to me that the Occupy movement here really hit on something. They hit on a thing that resonated, and they figured out a way to market it, right? They've got the slogan of We Are the 99%, and they've got this idea of Occupy. Is there the same thing in the Arab Spring and happening across that part of the world?
Well, actually, I see that the Occupy movement has much bigger challenges, because you have a nation that is so huge and so decentralized in many ways. It's very hard to get the nation behind you on such a cause. But I think they're doing pretty good for the time being. And I think people are starting to identify more and more. I think it's about targeting your people that you want to mobilize and the techniques and tools that you need to use for that.
Yeah, so tell me, what happens now? I mean, that challenge he speaks of is not insignificant.
Yeah, I think that in this country, there's a lot of people who are unemployed. There are people who are losing their homes. But there are also people who are doing okay. And in order to really build a mass-based movement, there are certainly people who say the worse things get, the larger our movement will grow. And, you know, small reforms that pacify people aren't actually helping us in the long run. There are people who think that. And there are other people who think that the worse things get, the worse things will get. And we won't be able to build a movement, and people won't have the freedom to fight. And I'm not exactly sure where I fall on that. But I do think that there is a sense that a lot of people need to get to desperation before they're willing to stand up and put everything on the line.
Ahmed, the people Tammy was talking about, the ones who are doing okay in this country, are you finding in Egypt and across the Middle East that the people who are doing okay are interested in what the democracy activists are saying?
I think what differentiates us in the East from the West is that we're still in the lower part of the food chain when it comes to democracy, freedom, and civil rights. So we have more to fight for. To engage those 1% and you tell them, take away bureaucracy and take away corruption, we could do way much better. A lot of people ask me in Tahrir Square, I mean, you look like from a decent and good background, great education, you have a great job. What made you go down on the street? Huh. And I respond to them exactly like this. I tell them that the day on the 28th of the Friday of Anger, I took both my little kids, 7 and 5, into my arms and I kissed them. And I wanted them to hear maybe my last words to them, which is, I'm going out to get you a better tomorrow.
Ahmed Naguib in Cairo, who's a pro-democracy activist there. Tammy Shapiro in New York City with the Occupy movement. Thank you both.
Thank you. That was lovely.
Thank you.
You can hear an extended version of our talk on our website. It goes about 15, 16, 17 minutes. It's marketplace.org. Coming up, football the way Freakonomics does it.
Defense wins championships.
What do you mean? Of course they do.
Not really true.
Again, I get the answer wrong. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials added 83 points, 2/3 of 1% today, closed at 12,758. The NASDAQ up 31 points, 1.1%, 28.18. The S&P 500 tacked on 11 points, 0.8%, finished at 13.26. The Fed, as I mentioned, said it's going to hold interest rates in place for a good long while. The end of 2014 is what Mr. Bernanke said. Bank stocks were mixed, though. Bank of America up 0.8%. J.P. Morgan Chase gave back a tenth. Citigroup up 0.2%. Hot on the heels of Apple's record profits, the stock polished up 6.25%. Today, another big winner was manufacturer Textron. Shares there jumped more than 14.5% after the company raised its earnings forecast for the year. Investors threw a stone at specialty glassmaker Corning, though, as manufacturers cut back on production of big-screen TVs that use Corning's glass. Shares lost more than 10%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to the Mendoza line, 2.0%. I've been waiting to use that one. You're listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on sales of new homes for December. President Obama continues his five-state tour with visits to Las Vegas, Nevada, and Denver, Colorado. And the Senate Budget Committee discusses the outlook for the U.S. and global economy. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. All right, so you got, say, $450 or so burning a hole in your pocket? As of the close in New York today, you could use that money to buy yourself one share of Apple. Stock watchers and tech analysts are still picking their collective jaws up off the floor today after Apple's report yesterday of its best quarter ever, revenue and profits. Buried not too deep in the numbers was the secret, profit margins of 44%. We asked Marketplace's Scott Tong to figure out how Apple does it.
Buy low, sell high has been a recipe for profits ever since the earth cooled. But how does Apple make a 60-70% margin per phone, 30% per iPad? Let's start with the low costs. Apple doesn't own factories. It contracts out manufacturing to Asian firms. And the company is so big it can hammer suppliers on price, the way Walmart and Costco do. Consultant Mike Levin is with Consumer Intelligence Research Partners.
They took ideas that, you know, Dell and others started to pioneer a decade or two ago, and really, you know, they didn't invent any of this. They just do it better than anybody else these days.
By some estimates, each iPhone includes about $190 in hardware costs, about $10 in Chinese labor. Now, if you're thinking sweatshop, the company responded to critics this month by naming its suppliers to be more transparent. But production costs are fairly similar across the industry. Where Apple really makes its money is charging a premium price for products we want that bad. Last quarter, the average iPhone sold for $660. That's a price shared by consumers and their wireless carriers. Here's MIT's Ed Steinfeld.
There are many standard recipes for baking a cake. Nonetheless, there are certain ways of doing it that really lead to an outstanding kind of cake, and one that is differentiable from virtually any other cake out there.
One we can't stop eating. One other differentiator? Apple put some of the same ingredients inside both the iPad and the iPhone, streamlining its supply chain. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
It's hard to imagine two companies that are more different than JCPenney and Apple. Consider the Apple Store. Sleek, artsy, cool, not a sale sign in sight, or a sale, for that matter. And then Penney's, packed with merchandise, sale signs stuck to half the racks, 60, 70, 80% off. The two do come together, though, in the person of Ron Johnson. While Johnson was at Apple, he helped invent the Apple Store. Today, as the new CEO of JCPenney, he rolled out his new retail strategy in New York. Low prices every day, way fewer markdowns, and way cooler stores. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has the story.
JCPenney's new ads feature people freaking out as they open their mailboxes to a tidal wave of coupons.
No!
The idea is that constant sales are making shoppers nuts. Penney's alone had almost 600 sales last year. Under the new plan, Penney's will cut everyday prices by about 40% and have just two sales a month. Allison Lipson is a retail analyst with Mintel International.
Rather than thinking, okay, I have to wait, and, you know, 2 weeks from now when they're having a big sale, I think the hope is that they'll feel better knowing that if they go into the store that they should be faced with lower prices.
The discounting arms race has been hard on stores' bottom lines, but shoppers are addicted to sales. Retail consultant Bert Flickinger says Penney's is taking a big gamble.
It's an inspired initiative, but carries real retail risk. Coupon usage is the highest that it's ever been in the U.S.
To give customers something in return, Penney's is offering a little atmosphere. Stores will have special areas where they offer promotions, like ice cream in the summer and free haircuts before school starts, trying to create a place where people hang out. You know, like the Apple Store.
Can JCPenney capture a little bit of that magic? And that's the billion-dollar question.
Forrester retail analyst Sucharita Molperu says revamping Penney's 1,100 stores may not be enough.
They have a CEO who has a history of being able to grow businesses by opening new flashy stores. And he actually doesn't really have experience growing flashy stores in really bad real estate locations.
And Penney's has plenty of those. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Time now for a little Freakonomics Radio. It's that moment every 2 weeks where we talk to Stephen Dubner, the co-author of the books and the blog of the same name. It's about the hidden side of everything, as you've heard me say before. Dubner, welcome back.
Hey, Guy, thank you. And listen, congratulations to you, your beloved New York Giants, heading back to the Super Bowl.
I know. How about that Eli Manning, huh? Peyton who?
Yeah. And so you're happy now, so it seems like a good time for me to confess a little something I've been hiding from you, which is I've been kind of two-timing.
Hey, ho, wait, what?
I've been doing these football Freakonomics segments for the NFL Network during the season.
All right. I don't love that, but okay, that's fine. Whatever.
All right. But here's the upside, which is I'd like to share with you a few of the things I've learned, kind of the hidden side of the Super Bowl, if you will.
Yeah, but Dubner, here's the thing. There are a lot of people who watch this game or you know, go to parties about it between the, you know, the dip and the beer and all that stuff, who don't really know a whole lot about football itself. So what do you got?
So if you want to impress your friends, you could explode some cherished football myths, such as here's one. Defense wins championships.
What do you mean? Of course they do.
Not really true. Now, of course, you'd rather have a great defense than a bad one, but statistically, if you look at past Super Bowls and just football in general, defense is not the magic bullet that the cliche suggests. And in fact, if you look at the matchup this year, during the regular season on defense, the Giants and the New England Patriots ranked 27th and 31st, respectively, out of 32 teams.
And in fact, actually, the games came down to special teams, the field goal units.
That's right. They both squeaked in. So which brings us, here's another myth. Icing the kicker. Now, that's where the opposing coach will call a timeout just as the poor field goal kicker is about to try this critical field goal to tie or win the game. And the idea is they're trying to get inside the kicker's head. Turns out, statistically, a kicker is no more likely to miss a kick if he's been iced. And in fact, it may even give him a slight advantage in that he's got a little bit more time to prepare for the kick.
So what does matter then?
Well, home field advantage is nice. You know, there's a real measurable effect, not just in football, but across all sports. However, it's not necessarily for the reasons we think, the old, you know, sleeping in your own bed and familiarity with the field. It turns out that probably the biggest single explanatory factor for home field advantage is the officials. They make more calls in favor of the home team. Now, NFL officials are very, very good, but they're also human. And on some level, most humans seek approval. And in this case, in the case of football, from, you know, 60,000 screaming fans, hard to ignore.
You know what? I got you here, Dubner. This is my aha moment with you. You ready? Here's the thing.
We live for these, yeah.
Unlike the NBA championships and unlike Major League Baseball and the World Series, the Super Bowl is played in a neutral site, right? It's in Indianapolis this year.
Correct. But here's the hidden side of the hidden side. Let's not forget.
That's very meta, dude. But anyway, go ahead.
Let's not forget that Giants quarterback Eli Manning has a big brother named Peyton, you referred to. Peyton Manning has been the backbone of the Indianapolis Colts for more than a decade.
Or the neck bone this season, but he wasn't. But anyway, go ahead.
That's exactly right. So he was out this year. But even so, the crowd at most Super Bowls is full of out-of-towners. I would not be shocked if there's enough pro-Manning family sentiment in Indianapolis to maybe translate into a slight home field edge for the Giants.
All right. Well, I certainly hope. Let me, though, speak on behalf of those who don't really know or care about the game and they just want to watch and go to the party. Is there a thing that they can use to perhaps pick a winner?
Here's the thing, Kai. You may not know this about me. I'm a bit of a crusader against bacterial infections, especially. No, I'm serious.
No, so am I. It surprises me not at all. You're a little
non sequitur coming from a Super Bowl, right? But especially in hospitals and other public places, I'm always railing against poor hand hygiene. Well, last week we had a football Freakonomics shoot in the Giants locker room, which was empty at the time. And guess what I saw there, Kai?
I don't know, man. What?
On top of every urinal in the Giants' locker room, there was a big dispenser of antibacterial solution. Right there on every urinal, I got to tell you. Even if Eli Manning is too laid back of a quarterback for your taste, or if you don't like Coach Tom Coughlin's old school style, from a public health perspective, I think you got to be rooting for Big Blue, the New York Giants.
Yeah, buddy, you heard it here first. Giants by two touchdowns over Tom Brady, I'm telling you.
Because their hands are cleaner.
That's right. Stephen Dubner, he does Freakonomics Radio. It's freakonomics.com, the website. We'll see you in a couple of weeks.
Okay, Kai. Good luck.
Yeah, man. Hey, I'm sorry about the Steelers, by the way.
Thank you very much. Yeah. I appreciate it.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, in which we provide the answer to the Greek debt crisis, came along with Apple's profit report yesterday. Bloomberg did a little math after it had had a chance to digest the numbers. Apple had $97.6 billion in cash in the bank as of the end of last year. Greece has $62 billion in debt coming due this year. So that's a bailout of a whole country, plus, say, the entire net worth of Boeing with $20 billion left over. We, however, have nothing left over. We got to go. That's Marketplace from APM American Public Media. Today, the Dow added 83 points, about 2/3%. The NASDAQ up 31 points, more than 1%. The S&P 500 tacked on 11 points, almost 1% there. Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard engineer the broadcast for us. Coming up next time back here, our series on Egypt's Arab Spring continues, democracy and economic uncertainty. I'm Kai Rizdal. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.